Hey, ghoul friend. It's me, Adrian, or Aiden. Either way, I want to ask you to wish Susto a happy birthday. As we celebrate the upcoming 5th anniversary of Susto and its dedication to exploring the rich tapestry of Latin American and Hispanic folklore, I invite you to join me in taking this paranormal project to the next level. Over the past 5 years, I've delved deep into the mysterious realms of ghostly apparitions, supernatural legends, and chilling tales that have captivated audiences worldwide. Now, as I embark on the next chapter of this journey into the unknown, I need your support to enhance your experience as a listener. Your generous donation will allow me to invest in a new recording setup, ensuring that future spine-chilling narratives are captured with crystal ball clarity and devilish detail. With upgraded equipment, I'll be able to host ghoulish guests with greater ease and transport you even deeper into the heart of darkness, where legends come alive and the paranormal awaits. Every dollar contributed will aid in advancing the quality of Susto, enabling me to continue preserving and sharing the enchanting folklore of Latin American and Hispanic cultures with the world. Join me in celebrating 5 years of fear-inducing tales and help me amplify this spooky saga for many more to come. Together, we can unlock the secrets of the supernatural and keep the spirit of storytelling alive. To make a donation, you can visit gofund.me/10bcdc27. Thank you for your support, and may the spirits guide you on your journey through the unknown. Eternally yours, Adrian or Aiden. Either way. Ghoul friends, it's me, Adrian, or Aiden. Either way, I am still your host, and you are still listening to Susto, the podcast of ooky spooky scary stories for the 5th year in a row. That's right, ghoul friends. Susto has officially turned 5 years old. If you are a Patreon subscriber on patreon.com/sustopodcast, then you may be listening to this on the actual 5 year anniversary, which is April 17th. And if you are not a Patreon subscriber and you're listening to the show a day later and possibly with ads, then you are hearing this the day after. Either way, what are the chances, you know, that these stars perfectly aligned for us to be here together for this episode to drop on these 2 days, the day of the 5 year anniversary and the day right after. I probably posted about this yesterday on the social medias. That's at Susto Podcast everywhere. I've said this before. I cannot believe it's been 5 years. It feels simultaneously like it's been longer. It doesn't feel like it's been 5 years. It feels like I've been doing this for 10 years. At the same time, it feels like it's gone by in a blur. Like it's happened so fast. I feel like I just started the show yesterday. I don't know what it is. I think it's because we have been able to do so much with Susto. I have been able to accomplish so much, and I am so proud of all the work that I've been able to do with Susto. And that's all because of you. You, the listeners, my ghoul friends, the Susto fam, you have made this all possible. Without the listeners, there would be no Susto. I mean, sure, I would probably be making the show, but the whole point of the show is to share the stories, is to share this experience, is to connect through a level of fear, as I've said many times before. And without people to share that with, then that feeling wouldn't be recreated. So I don't even know what to say. I feel speechless, but more than anything, I feel so grateful and so thankful. And I cannot thank everybody enough. Everyone who has followed online, who has subscribed to Patreon, who has listened to the show, sent in their stories, written reviews, shared with your own ghoul friends. It has all meant so, so much to me. Yeah, I'm going to try not to ramble on too much about it. One, because I could ramble on about it for an hour solid at least, and I don't want to cry like I normally do. So I will just leave it at saying a million and one times thank you from the bottom of my heart. I am eternally grateful to all of you. With that being said, as you heard in the pre-roll, in honor of Susto's 5-year anniversary, I launched a GoFundMe to try and raise money to invest in a new recording setup for Susto. I won't give you the entire spiel again. I will be making social media posts about it. I feel like now that we have officially hit the 5-year anniversary, I really want to push that GoFundMe. So for those of you who have donated, thank you again. This is just an episode of thank yous. But again, I have to say it every time because it boggles my mind that anybody can see the vision that I have for Sustal. And so I don't know what to say. I'm just gonna try and push through all of the good, positive, happy feelings. But yeah, there's that. As always, you can follow any and all updates on the show, including live events that I have coming up. So you should know that in May next month, I will be at the Curious Twins Psychic and Spirit Fest in San Antonio. There is links to all of that on my link tree, which you can find in the bios of all of my social media or on my website, sustopodcast.com. So when I was thinking of this week's episode, I was thinking, what can I do? What can I do? What can I do to make an episode, but also to celebrate Susto and these last 5 years? So what I decided to do was to, for the first time ever, put together a supercut of Susto, a spooktacular, if you will, of the top 5 most popular episodes. And this is according to my host website, which unfortunately I was really trying to think of a way, how can I search for sentiment. And for those of you who work in public relations and in marketing, you'll know that there are some platforms that will allow you to like track for sentiment. I don't think I have enough data to to look into that for Susto. So maybe in the next milestone, I will ask you all for your favorite moments on the show and I'll highlight those. But for today, like I said, this is the 5-year spooktacular supercut, and I'm bringing you the top five most popular story episodes of Susto. And I believe those are Martin Busca Villanova, Legends of the Panteón de Belén, Dance with the Devil, the Resurrected Version, Isla de las Muñecas, and Tlahuelpuchi. So it's just going to be the story portions of the episodes today. So a look back into the vault, into the dungeon of the episodes that we've done in the past that were really popular. So I hope that you enjoy today's listen. A little bit of nostalgia, a little bit of reminiscing on the good times that we have had and that we will continue to have for the next at least another 5 years, and then we'll take it from there, right? As always, the easiest way to support the show is by sharing it with your network of ghoul friends, with your own haunted house. You can also leave a rating or review on Apple Podcasts or on the Spotify Q&A. If you have your own scary story to share, you know how to do that. You can email me, message me on social media. You can submit it on the website. And it also does not have to be a written story. If you have a spooky photo, video, audio recording that you would like me to feature on a Letters from the Beyond episode or on social media, go ahead and send it in any of those various ways. You can also use a summoning circle. Actually, if you're listening on Spotify or on the social media post for today's episode, what 5 things would you put in a summoning circle to summon me, your ghost host? While you're thinking of that, and without any further ado, we are going to get the spooktacular started. God, it feels so good to say the 5-year Susto spooktacular. In the Playa Ancha Cemetery No. 3, in Valparaíso, Chile, there is a rather particular tomb, which, if its history is unknown to passersby, can go easily unnoticed. However, the lore surrounding it could possibly be one of the only instances of a person who was able to deceive the devil after making a deal. The story begins at the end of the 19th century, with an impoverished Spaniard arriving in Valparaíso, a port city, a man who, like many, was on a quest to improve his life and grow a fortune in the world-famous Jewel of the Pacific. With its commercial prosperity in the mid-19th century came a massive influx of immigrants who braved the dangerous trip around Cape Horn to settle in the city's bustling neighborhoods. The alleged unholy contract seeker, Martin Busca Villanova, encountered no fortune nor opportunity upon his arrival. It is said he spent weeks, possibly months, homeless on the streets of the port. He made a living off of whittling whistles and scraps of food he scavenged for. But everything changed when seemingly overnight, the wayward Spaniard went from living in destitution to becoming one of the richest men in the city. Nobody understood how this man, from very humble beginnings, was suddenly dressed in elegant suits, began to invest in businesses, and bought a beautiful home. It wasn't until his old age that he revealed his secret pact with Satan. After invoking the Prince of Darkness, the agreement they came to was quite simple. The devil would grant Martin all the riches that he desired in exchange for his soul, which the devil would collect after his death and at the moment his flesh and bones touched the ground. The years passed, and Don Martin became a great and generous benefactor to his friends and the poor of the city, for which he became one of the most beloved porteños of his time. However, a problem was always on his mind: his pact with the devil and how to break that agreement. Looking for a solution, he confided in his closest circle about the problem. Shortly after, Martí moved to the Casablanca Valley, where locals reported a dark carriage drawn by black steeds that would approach his house in the middle of the night. Due to the constant harassment from who many deduced was Satan himself, Martín returned to his home on the port, where he initially found his fortune and struck the infamous deal. Legend is unclear whether Martin himself came up with the idea or if it was one of his friends who gave it to him. Regardless of who thought up the loophole, Martin already had intentions to terminate his wicked contract with the devil before returning to the port. At the age of 77, Martin commissioned the construction of a mausoleum. The community regarded the crypt as strange and unique, a completely earthquake-proof structure that housed a stone coffin in the center, inscribed with his date of birth, death, and the name, Martin Busca V. One of the features that attracts the most attention from those who pause to admire it is the base of his tomb, which is suspended in the air thanks to a paw on each corner, each with six fingers. Many say that it is Martin's final joke against the devil and the superstition around the number 666. This allegedly allows Martin Busca to have his eternal rest, thus avoiding the pact he made with the devil, since his soul would belong to Satan only when his bones touched the earth. To this day, Martin's remains continue to hover only inches above the ground and just out of reach of the King of Demons. It is said visitors who stop to pay their respects ask Martin for favors, and those who are brave enough to walk through the cemetery at night can still hear the devil searching for the soul of the man who managed to deceive him. The Panteón de Belén, also known as Santa Paula Cemetery, is located north of the Metropolitan Cathedral of Guadalajara in the heart of Mexico's third largest city. The name Cementerio de Santa Paula, or in English, the St. Paula Cemetery, comes from the fact that there is a chapel dedicated to the saint on the cemetery grounds. The cemetery was designed by the famous Mexican architect Manuel Gómez Ibarra, who, 30 years earlier, redesigned the spires of the Guadalajara Cathedral, which were destroyed in an earthquake. The Panteón de Belén, or Santa Paula Cemetery, was built to meet the need for more burial spots for victims of the epidemics, primarily cholera. Perhaps due to this tragic origin, the cemetery is shrouded in myths and tales of ghosts roaming the grounds. Local lore includes the legends of the pirate, the lovers, the monk, the nun, the vampire tree, the child afraid of the dark, and more. People have claimed to see these deceased residents haunting the graveyard over the years. The cemetery now offers night tours of the grounds, functioning as a sort of museum of the macabre. May 24, 1882. A big storm was about to hit the city of Guadalajara. A young couple was putting their 10-year-old son to bed. His name was Ignacio Torres Altimirano, and his parents and grandparents lovingly called him Nachito. As Nachito was afraid of the dark, he always slept with two lit torches outside his bedroom window and with the windows open. On the night the storm hit Guadalajara, the torches were blown out by its raging winds. That next morning, Nachito's mother entered his room and could immediately tell something was very wrong, as the room was uncharacteristically and extremely cold. She ran to her son's bedside to find Nachito motionless and as cold as the room itself. Later, it was determined that Nachito had died of a heart attack because of his intense, almost pathological fear of the dark. Rumors began to spread that the young boy's heart had exploded inside his chest, and Nachito's horrible death was the result of a curse or was the work of demons. Nachito was buried at the nearby cemetery, called by locals El Panteón de Belén, and the next morning, the boy's coffin was found disinterred and lying on the ground next to the hole that was his grave. His parents and the locals alike were alarmed, and the cemetery caretaker reburied the boy's coffin. However, the next morning, the same thing happened, and it happened again for the next 9 days. Nachito's parents concluded that because the boy was so afraid of the dark, he did not want to be kept in the ground away from the light. The solution? Make a stone coffin standing on 4 short pillars above the ground, so Nachito's tomb could always see sunlight. Since the time of Nachito's death, many people visiting the cemetery have claimed to have either seen or heard the young boy, or have seen mysterious balloons floating evenly a few meters over the cemetery as if being carried by a child. Nachito's grave draws the brave and curious from all parts of Mexico, some of whom leave him a toy and ask him for a favor in return. On Children's Day, which locally is celebrated on April 30th, and Christmas Day especially, the area surrounding Nachito's final resting place becomes covered in small toys and plush animals. The caretakers of the cemetery always donate the offerings to local children's hospitals. According to another popular tale, a swashbuckling man once sailed the Pacific during his youth and attacked many ships laden with the riches from around the world. As a middle-aged man, the pirate decided to settle and make a real life for himself in Guadalajara. He had only one son who did not know of his father's former life as a pirate. It seems that the man had stashed somewhere in the Guadalajara area a massive treasure of mostly gold and precious stones. A few months after hiding it, the man died and was buried in the Santa Paula Cemetery. According to the legend, if a devout person visits the pirate's grave at midnight and prays the rosary for the man's tormented soul, the ghost of the pirate will reveal the exact location of the treasure. Over the years, many people have prayed for the pirate's soul in hopes of him revealing the treasure's location, but none have yet succeeded. Another Santa Paula legend is about a child who is connected to the former hospital next door. A young boy named Santiago was suffering from a terminal stomach ailment, and in some versions of the story, it is an aggressive type of cancer. During one of her visits, Santiago's mother brought the boy one of his favorite saint statues from home to help give her son comfort through his illness. While he was sleeping, the mother placed the small statue in the boy's hands, and when he awoke, he threw the statue against the wall, cursing God for giving him such a terrible disease. He yelled to anyone who would hear his wish that God himself would contract the horrible illness that he was suffering from. Santiago ended his rant by saying something like, "If God gets this disease, let's see who will cure him." That night, the boy's pain was more intense than ever, and he wandered outside the hospital and into the cemetery. The next morning, the boy's body was found hanging from a tree, with the hospital bed sheets used as a noose. Sometimes at night, people claim to see the boy hanging from a tree inside the Santa Paula Cemetery. This story is often told by parents to their children so they will not lose their faith in God. One of the most interesting stories connected with this cemetery is that of a vampire. In the mid-1800s, scores of small animals were found throughout Guadalajara dead and drained of their blood. After months of this eerie event, the same phenomenon started to happen to human infants. The alarmed citizenry then formed a vigilante group to hunt down the supposed vampire who is responsible for this. The mob rounded up a few suspects and singled out the palest and most, quote, vampiric-looking man of the group. As is customary according to the legendary rules in vampire lore, they drove a stake through the man's heart to kill him. The group then took the man's body to Santa Paula, placing it in an empty grave and covered by a stone slab. Locals rejoiced when the vampire attacks ceased, thus proving they had killed the right man. Time passed, and a tree started to grow over the slab covering the vampire's grave. It is said that if you break one of its branches, it will spurt blood, and even the leaves of the tree will leave a strange red residue in your hands if you handle them. The tree is now rather large, with a huge root system that grabs the slab like the tentacles of an octopus. It is said that when the tree's root system eventually breaks the slab, or causes a gap that opens the tomb, the vampire will escape and seek revenge on the modern citizens of a cosmopolitan Guadalajara. Finally, popular also is the story of Victoriana Hurtado, a woman who was born in 1833 and who suffered from catalepsy since she was a child. According to legend, she was buried alive by her own children, Octaviano, Alejandro, and Javier, who took advantage of the fact that their mother's illness at times made her suffer in a state of stiffness, unconsciousness, and diminution of pulse. However, despite their best nefarious efforts, they were unsuccessful in their mission to inherit the fortune of Victoriana. The wealthy woman had left every penny to charity. The truth came to light only after the cemetery's groundskeeper heard a terrible cry from the tomb of the woman the night after her burial. When he arrived, he saw the bloodied hand of Victoriana who tried to escape the tomb. It was later determined that she died of a heart attack before she could. The cemetery is also recognized for its historic architecture and its many high-profile burials. Panteón de Belén used to be divided into two parts, one for the wealthy and one for the regular, quote, commoners. The latter was converted to a hospital after the cemetery's closing in 1896, but the section for the wealthy has remained intact. Santa Paula's largest building is the main mausoleum, which contains 900 resting places. The cemetery draws many thousands of tourists per year who not only come to view the architectural beauty or to enjoy the adjacent museum, but come for the nighttime ghost tours and are fascinated by its many legends. Hey ghoul friend, it's me, Adrian, or Aiden. Either way, it's that time of year. The True Crime and Paranormal Podcast Festival is right around the corner, so make sure that you get your tickets. You can visit truecrimepodcastfestival.com and use code SUSTO15 for 15% off your tickets. This year, the festival is in Denver, Colorado from July 12th through 14th, so if possible, I would love to see you there. I can't wait. And again, make sure to use code SUSTO15 for 15% off your tickets at truecrimepodcastfestival.com. Friday the 13th, 1979, which coincidentally happened to be a Good Friday, wound up turning into a night that became the stuff of legends. A warning for generations to come that varies from region to region, its ending always the same. A young woman named Magdalena, in this version, had high hopes of attending her first dance at Boccaccio 2000, a popular nightclub in McAllen, Texas. But her strictly religious parents forbade her from doing so, calling the club a place of sin and for the devil. However, Magdalena had different plans. Fed up with her saintly life of obedience, she decided to lie to her parents. She told them she'd be attending an evening church event with friends, when in reality, she could already hear the disco music. After her parents retreated to their bedroom, she slipped on a dress she borrowed from a friend, something her parents would never allow her to wear, quickly did her makeup in the dim light of her vanity lamp, and snuck out. The night was going just as Magdalena dreamt it would. For a moment, she broke away from her group of friends and through the crowd to drink some water. Suddenly, a hush went over the sounds of the club. She looked up from her drink, and standing in front of her was a striking, handsome man dressed all in black. Dance with me. A command, more than a request. Magdalena had always refused the attention of admirers because of her religious upbringing and the warning of her parents. But her parents weren't there that night. She replied with a whispered yes. He whisked her away onto the dance floor. He held her close and tight, swaying and spinning for what felt like hours to her. For a moment, it was as if only they existed in a dark, secluded pocket outside of this world. But that moment was shattered by shrieks and screams. As Magdalena came out of her trance-like state, she could hear and see onlookers pointing and screaming at the couple. His feet! Look at his feet! She looked down and saw that her handsome stranger's feet were a goat's hoof and a chicken's talon. She had been dancing with the devil. In the time it took for the crowd to disperse enough for security to make it to the cause of the commotion, the man was gone. Vanished into thin air, leaving behind only the scent of sulfur and Magdalena unconscious on the floor. She was rushed to the hospital for burns that appeared to be handprints left on her body where the devil held and caressed her. One bouncer reported the heavy metal doors of the club swinging open after the devil had been found out, but convinced himself it was only the wind since he couldn't recall seeing anyone open them. Some say that the club was destined for an encounter with evil due to the fact that the company who owned the club, Edwin Bush Incorporated, shared its name with a confessed murderer. Now, there is only an empty lot where the club used to stand, perhaps waiting for a brave soul to rebuild a club where the devil can dance again. Drifting through a boat through a tangle of narrow canals in Xochimilco, a district of Mexico City, you will find yourself heading toward an isolated island. Though it may seem like any other island at first, as you move closer, you'll start to see the dolls. Yes, dolls. It is called Isla de las Muñecas, or Island of the Dolls. Home to thousands of mutilated toys hanging from the trees and lying on the forest floor, eyeless skulls infested by insects. The island is a place of horror and mystery, where the dolls are said to move and whisper, and the spirit of a drowned girl is said to haunt the island. The island is shrouded in mystery and legend, with eerie stories of hauntings and supernatural occurrences that have been passed down for generations. Many who have ventured to the island have reported feeling a sense of unease and terror, and some claim to have encountered the spirits of the dead who are said to haunt the place. The origin of the island's macabre collection of dolls is said to date back to the 1950s, when a man by the name of Don Julian Santana Barrera moved to the island with his family. According to legend, Don Julian discovered the body of a young girl who had drowned in the canal, and he became haunted by her spirit. In an effort to appease her spirit, he hung a doll on a tree in her memory, but the doll was not enough, and so he hung another, and another, and another, until the trees were covered in them. Over the years, Don Julian's collection grew, and he devoted much of his life to maintaining and expanding it. He would scour the nearby garbage dumps and markets for discarded dolls, often trading produce from his garden in exchange. As the years passed, the island became more and more crowded with dolls of all shapes and sizes, some missing limbs, others with broken faces. The dolls themselves are a strange and unsettling sight. Some of them are old-fashioned with porcelain faces and glassy eyes. Others are cheap plastic toys, their features distorted and twisted. Some of them are dressed in frilly dresses and bonnets, while others are naked or barely clothed. Despite the eerie nature of the dolls, Don Julian reportedly found comfort in their company, believing that they helped to protect him from evil spirits. However, his strange behavior and the island's reputation as a place of horror, grief, and dread led to rumors and whispers among the locals. As the years went by, Don Julian became increasingly isolated, spending most of his time on the island with his dolls. He believed that the dolls were alive, that they were watching him, and that they were the only company he needed. He would talk to them, and sometimes he would hear them whispering back. After Don Julian's death in 2001, the island was left abandoned, and the dolls were left to decay and rot. However, their presence remains, and many visitors to the island have reported feeling a strange energy or presence around them. Many people believe that the dolls are possessed by the spirit of the girl who drowned, that her restless soul inhabits the dolls, moving them and whispering through them. Some visitors to the island have reported hearing the dolls giggling and calling to them by name or beckoning them to come closer, as if saying, "Join us." Others have even claimed to see the dolls move on their own, their heads turning to follow the movement of visitors as they make their way through the island. Despite the island's reputation for being haunted and cursed, it continues to draw visitors from all over the world, drawn by its eerie and unsettling beauty. Many are fascinated by the story of Don Julian and the mysterious young girl who is said to haunt the island, while others are simply intrigued by the bizarre and macabre spectacle. However, for those who have experienced the island firsthand, there is a sense that something is not quite right there. The dolls, with their dead eyes and twisted features, seem to hold a dark and malevolent energy that can be felt throughout the island. Some have even reported feeling physically ill or dizzy when surrounded by the dolls, as if their presence is overwhelming and oppressive. One visitor, a photographer, describes her experience on the island as follows. "As soon as we stepped onto the island, I felt a strange energy wash over me. It was like nothing I had ever experienced before. A mixture of fear, unease, and excitement. The dolls were everywhere, hanging from the trees and staring out at us with their blank, lifeless eyes. It was as if they were watching us, waiting for us to make a move. As we made our way through the island, I couldn't shake the feeling that we were being followed. I kept turning around, expecting to see someone or something behind us, but there was only the dolls, their eerie silence filling the air. At one point, I caught a glimpse of one of the dolls moving out of the corner of my eye. I turned to look at it, but it was still and silent, as if nothing had happened. I brushed it off as my imagination, but the feeling of being watched only intensified. It wasn't until we left the island that I felt a sense of relief. The dolls and their haunting energy seemed to fade away as we put distance between us and the island. But even now, months later, I can't shake the feeling that something stayed with me from that place, something dark and unsettling." The Isla de Muñecas is a place of great mystery and intrigue. a place where the lines between reality and the supernatural seem to blur. Whether you believe in ghosts and hauntings or not, there is no denying the eerie and unsettling presence of the dolls that populate the island. For those brave enough to venture there, it is an experience unlike any other, one that will stay with them long after they have left the island's haunted shores. December 8, 1960. An unseasonably cold night in San Pedro Xolotla, a rural, primarily Nahuatl-speaking community beneath La Malinche volcano in the Mexican state of Tlaxcala. Filemón and Francisca, a couple in their early 30s, were working late carding wool and making yarn. Like most households in the community, they supported themselves with their weaving. They lived in one room of Filemón's parents' extended household with their four children, two boys and a girl between 5 and 14 years old, and a 7-month-old daughter, Cristina. Around midnight, Filemón's older brother returned from Mexico City, where he had gone to deliver an order of sarapes. The three of them had coffee and chatted, then all retired for the night. Filemón, exhausted, fell asleep immediately. But Francisca gave baby Cristina one last breastfeeding. Then she put Cristina back in her crib before going to bed herself. 2 or 3 hours later, Francisca awoke and saw a glowing light moving around outside the bedroom window. She tried to get up to investigate, but her body felt heavy and unresponsive, and she soon fell back asleep. A little later, she half woke again. A strange mist filled the room, and out of it materialized a large bird-like creature. Again, she tried to get up, but the mist overcame her, and that's all she remembered. As the sun rose, Filemón woke up and noticed that the door to the room was partially open. Then he saw baby Cristina lying not in her crib, but on the floor a few feet away. He got up to investigate while Francisca was still fast asleep. It took several minutes for Filemón to wake Francisca from her deep slumber with the terrible news. Baby Cristina was dead. The skin around her chest and neck was bruised, and she was pale, as if she had been drained of her blood. That same morning, 6 other families were shaken out of trance-like sleeps to a similar discovery. A still, tiny body. Sometimes an open door. 7 dead babies. It was the Tlahuelpuchi epidemic. The blood-sucking shapeshifter Tlahuelpuchi looks like an ordinary person and lives in any family, but they must consume human blood at least once a month to survive. They hunt in the form of an animal, usually a turkey or vulture. Tlahuelpuchis prefer the blood of infants, and they hunt the most in cold or rainy weather. In Tlaxcalan lore, they strike most often in cold and or wet weather. They hunt whenever they are hungry, but prefer to strike in the middle of the night. To hunt, they fly from village to village in their bird form, or as a hovering ball of light in the night. It is said you can tell if an animal is a Tlahuelpuchi by its glowing aura and the faint smell of blood. After a Tlahuelpuchi picks a victim, they wait outside for a good opportunity to sneak into the house. Some people say that to enter the house, the Tlahuelpuchi must fly over the roof in the shape of a cross, from east to west and north to south. Others say she can sneak in as a paralyzing mist that knocks out everyone in the room. Once inside, she turns back into a bird and sucks her victim's blood with her long, needle-like tongue. When she escapes, she leaves the victim's body by the door. The position of the body, along with bruises around the victim's chest, upper back, or neck, are the signs of a Tlahuelpuchi attack. You can try to protect yourself or your baby from the Tlahuelpuchi in many ways. leave a sharp object under the crib, a knife, scissors, needles, or pins. Make a cross out of safety pins on your garments. Put a mirror or dirty shorts or a soiled diaper near the bed. But none of these are foolproof. Only onions or garlic are guaranteed to ward off an attack. You cannot tell who the Tlawalpuchi in your midst might be. Sometimes they don't know themselves until they hit puberty and begin to crave blood. They can be any gender, but are mostly women. It is said the stronger, meaner, more bloodthirsty ones are typically women. A Tlawalpuchi can't kill their own family unless that family member tries to give their identity away. In turn, a family member who is responsible for the death of a Tlawalpuchi will turn into one themselves, leaving families to live with the secret. Though a Tlawalpuchi can hunt or shapeshift anytime they need to, once a month they must go through a ritual. After midnight, they light a fire in the kitchen with certain types of wood and leaves that have magical properties. They walk over the fire 3 times, first north to south, then east to west, chanting incantations as they do so. Then, they sit on the fire facing north. Their upper body separates from their legs and feet, and they turn into a bird and fly out into the night, leaving their legs behind. If the Tlawalpuchi doesn't find a victim by daybreak, they will die. In the stress and terror of a rash of deaths, people will accuse their neighbors of being the Tlawalpuchi. That person is executed, stoned or clubbed to death, their body left in a ravine. This is rare and fortunately didn't happen in San Pedro Xolotla. Normally, when a child died in rural Tlaxcala, their funeral procession was filled with music. Mourners sang and made noise on the way to the cemetery. Perhaps this was a way to comfort the spirit of the child on their first and last journey without their parents. But the funeral of a Tlawalpuchi victim was a silent affair. No priest said prayers over the casket. No one said a word until the padrinos condemned the baby's soul to God as they erected the cross over their grave. It is tradition for the padrinos to visit the grave after 8 days, also known as the Octava de Cruz. But this didn't happen for a Tlawalpuchi victim. After the wake, all the child's clothes and possessions were burned. They had no Octava de Cruz, no flowers were ever placed on their graves, nor were they remembered on the family altar on Dia de los Muertos. They were rarely spoken of again. It's as if the child never existed, a tragedy the family tried to wish away. Anthropologist Hugo Nutini had been conducting field studies nearby at the time of the epidemic, and stayed to observe the community in the aftermath of the tragedy. He posited that the close kinship ties in the community prevented any accusations, since Tlawalpuchi cannot attack their own family. So what led to the onslaught of infant deaths? Over the next decade, Nutini studied 47 of these cases, bringing in a doctor to examine the bodies or examine them himself. While the medical professionals wouldn't speak definitively about the cause of death without an autopsy, the bruising of the victims' bodies provided a strong clue. The victims hadn't lost blood, but oxygen. Welcome back, ghoul friends, and one more time, thank you, and thank you. Again, make sure to visit Susto on social media. That's at Susto Podcast on every social media platform. If you have your own scary story or a photo, video, audio recording that you think is spooky and you would like me to share on a Letters from the Beyond episode or on the social media platforms, you can send it to me via email, DM on social media, a rating or a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, or you can visit my website, sustopodcast.com. Again, follow social media for any and all updates, including live events that I have coming up. If you are feeling like extra generous and you would like to help me invest in a new recording setup, you can visit the GoFundMe. Again, that link is gofund.me/10bcdc27. And all of this information, all of these links are on my link tree, which are on the bios of the social medias or on the website. And one final thing, for those of you already supporting Sustol, the Patreon subscribers over at patreon.com/sustolpodcast, your support makes each and every episode possible. And this episode's patrons are Liza, Sadie, Rachel, Alejandra, Luther, April, Mario, Eva, Dee, Josette, Sam, Angela & Co., Mandy, Jules, Lori, Jeannie, Desiree, C, Anna C, Ashes, Neresa, Rachel A, Asukena, Rios, Anna, Marlene, Chata, Lainey, Desiree A, Aaliyah, Holly, Cynthia, and Carla. Thank you all so much. If you are interested in signing up for Patreon, you can visit patreon.com/sustolpodcast, check out the tiers and the benefits and see if any of those work for you. But for now, thank you all so much for listening. I will talk to you in the next one, and let's circle back in about 5 more years, yeah? Bye.